Welcome to This Is Money podcast in partnership with NS&I. I'm your host, Georgie Frost, and alongside editor Simon Lambert and I today is consumer affairs editor Lee Boyce. And coming up, more money for the NHS. But where should it come from? Cutting costs, tax rises, Brexit dividends? Also today, where you can still get good returns on buy-to-let, why drivers outside of London should care about the capital's low-emission plans, and could travelling like a Premier League star be the answer to the current rail chaos? Don't forget you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, where safer savings set you free.
But first, the NHS is 70 years old this year, and boy could it do with a birthday present. We're living longer with more complex issues and the service needs more cash. We'll step up Theresa May with plans for a £20.5 billion a year cash boost. But where will that money come from? That's another thing. Where it goes? Well, that's probably a little bit outside the remit of this podcast. So, do we make cost cuttings? Do we plough lots more money in? Do we increase income tax, make the rich pay more, or introduce a new special ring-fence tax? And what about a Brexit dividend? Is the Boris bus back? So, firstly, a very warm welcome to you both. Problems with the NHS. Why is everybody talking about this? Simon?
Because the NHS is expensive. Mm-hmm. And the NHS is getting more expensive with every year that passes because the population is getting older. And, while they may be wiser, are more expensive to treat because they tend to have more health problems the longer people live. In fact, many of the successes that we have had in keeping people alive are very expensive. And as a nation, it's widely considered that we would like to stick with the free at the point of use healthcare service that we have in terms of the NHS. Everybody is covered by healthcare. If you were going to design a healthcare system, the argument from a lot of people who work in healthcare, not just in the NHS, but the kind of people who look at all the different healthcare systems around the world, arguably the UK's is a pretty good one and you'd go for that kind of model. The difficulty is that whilst NHS funding has been protected in the years of austerity, as we tried to balance the books, having had to bail out our banks due to the fact that we borrowed stupendous amounts of money and allowed lots of reckless financial practices to go on throughout the 2000s, it has only been protected in the sense that it's not gone up. But actually, we need to be spending more money every year because, as I explained, we have an NHS that is getting more and more expensive. So the widely considered figure that is needed is £20 billion. Now, Theresa May announced that we were going to get
year,
that.
Right?
A year,
right.
An extra £20 billion a year. Theresa May announced we were going to get that. She actually said £20.5 billion. There is one small difficulty with that. That is by 2023. And it won't escape many people's notice that although this year is passing extremely rapidly and we're now right bang in the middle of it, that's 5 years away. So actually, that only represents a 3.4% increase a year, whereas the health experts say that we need 4%. So it's still not quite enough, but it's a long way towards what the NHS probably needs.
While we don't normally like tax rises, and indeed I believe it was the Conservatives that said in their manifesto that they didn't want to raise taxes, this doesn't seem to be such an unpopular idea with the public, including this concept of a special sort of ring fence tax for the NHS.
Well, I think people, if you're going to bring in a tax increase, people like to know where that tax and where that extra money is going to be going to. Now, if there's one place that people don't mind the money going to, I would argue it probably is the NHS. A fantastic service, and I think a lot of us sometimes forget, you know, we may have had some bad experiences at hospitals and whatnot, but actually we are incredibly lucky to have that, you know, there. And yeah, we pay our taxes to use that. And if we are saying that more money needs to be pumped into the NHS, I think if people can actually see that, hey, like, you've got to pay an extra few quid a year and this is getting ring fenced and it's going to the NHS and this is where the money's going, what's going to be done with the money, I think people are probably more inclined to go, do you know what, okay, you know, we are getting older as a population, there does need to be more money put into the health service. And people are probably more happy to do that than other projects, I would argue. So sometimes it has to be done. But I was looking at some figures, and it's quite interesting because they're saying that the average annual rise since the foundation of the NHS 70 years ago is 3.7%. And then what happened, it kind of dipped under that a little bit under Thatcher and John Major, only a little bit. And then Tony Blair and the Gordon Brown era, it went up to 6%. It was a big old jump in those new Labour years. And then the coalition came in 2010 and it went down to 1%. So it's really been skewed. Yeah. And I think actually that's put a lot of pressure now down the line onto the NHS. It's not just the population getting older. We're getting fatter. We're getting, you know, more unhealthy.
Also, I wonder, Lee, are other issues being brought into the NHS and where the funding needs to go than perhaps was originally planned for? I'm thinking things like mental health.
Oh, 100%. And, you know, again, these are all sorts of areas that need to be looked at. And I'd actually like to see a bit of a review of if there is some fat to be trimmed in the NHS and perhaps where some money could be moved over to other services that maybe need it more. But it's very difficult to balance it all. And there's a lot of different problems that people have across the country. And it's a very sort of difficult thing to get your head around. And it's such a mammoth organisation. I think the NHS, you know, it's one of the biggest employers in the world. I mean, it's a massive organisation. It's very difficult at a national level to look at everything. I like to think that things get a little bit more localised and seeing what needs to be done and where money needs to be moved. And you're right, there's things that have come out money-wise that I think that haven't been accounted for in the past. And again, it's making things, you know, way more expensive for the NHS.
Well, the Chancellor did say that we will have to pay more in taxes, but he would do it in a fair and balanced way. And he is also saying that the government will stick to its promise to reduce the nation's debt. How is this going to be possible?
Well, we've not got the exact details on that, and we're not going to get the exact details on that until the budget. Because what has been said is the NHS can have this money, but what they want the NHS to do between now and then is come up with a 10-year plan. And the NHS needs to work out how it's best going to spend this money, how it's going to trim out any unnecessary costs that it faces. It might even involve a wholesale reorganisation of the NHS, because there was these things called clinical commissioning groups that were started up. And the idea was that effectively, that's the stuff that isn't done by hospitals, but was previously done by GPs. They'd have to organise everything. But you put these groups in place that would be able to benefit from widespread negotiation, driving down the prices with suppliers, negotiating better deals, and just be better placed to do this kind of thing. Now, they haven't really been a resounding success, and there's now an argument that maybe they need to be taken out. The problem is every time you have a reorganisation, it's expensive. The figures that Lee mentioned there about the amount of money that went into the NHS are very interesting, but they don't tell the whole story. And through the 2000s, we put a lot of money into the NHS, and that was really good. However, not all of that money, but a lot of that money went into very, very high salaries for lots more bosses. So this was the problem, is a load of money was thrown at the NHS, but there was very little control about how it went in. Now, the classic example of that, not to go all Richard Littlejohn column on us, but was the Guardian jobs section, if you remember that, in its heyday of the sort of early to mid 2000s, which was a job section that came with The Guardian on a Saturday, and it just got bigger and bigger and bigger. And you had these jobs, five a day coordinators. I mean, who knew we needed a five a day coordinator and things like that? But it wasn't even the five a day coordinators that were the real problem. It was the people at the top, this level of middle and upper management, earning 80, 90, 100,000 pounds a year, and lots and lots and lots of them. And the problem is, when you've got an organisation as big as the NHS, and we've seen this with companies like Tesco, for example, gigantic. When you start to then try and trim costs, you suddenly discover that it's almost impossible, because everything you look at and go, well, should we be doing this, and should we be paying that person? That person goes, well, hang on a minute, I'm busy all the time. And you look at all these things and go, yeah, well, they're absolutely necessary. So it becomes very difficult. Now, apparently 50% of this money is going to come from tax, and 50% of this money is going to come from extra borrowing a little bit more money. The idea behind the tax thing and whether we have a hypothecated tax is very interesting. A hypothecated tax is a fancy word for ring fencing the money. Now, there's good points to that and there's bad points.
Right, exactly. So tell us what's... Obviously, the good point is you know where it's going, but the bad points and stuff is what happens if you over-exceed that target? What happens if you under? Are you going to take money from somewhere else?
So you've hit the nail on the head there. The good points are that people know where the money is going and people are happier to pay the extra tax. So if you said to people, tax is going to go up by 2p in the pound, everybody... Well, why? Things aren't getting any better. Look at all the holes in the road. You're just going to waste it. If you say your tax is going to go up by 2p in a pound because it's going to help the NHS and protect the NHS, then you think, okay, well, that's all right. Mm. And you have to bear in mind as well, these tax rises will fall upon two sections of people. One, the younger working population who are effectively being asked to pay more tax in order to pay for the health service that is becoming more expensive due to the older population, who, not to get into intergenerational issues and things like mm-hmm. that, but they are the people who benefited from the house price rises, the final salary pensions, all those other things. And they're now supporting that younger generation, but that younger generation is being asked to pay for them. And I think there needs to be a recognition of that. But also it's going to fall on higher earners. Now, the difficulty with higher earners is that it's all very well saying, well, they need to pay their way, as Jeremy Corbyn did during the last election. But actually, if you look at the figures, they do actually pay their way. They more than pay their way. Yeah. In fact, they pay an awful lot of money. And people who are lucky enough to earn lots of money, i.e. someone who's lucky enough to earn £100,000. Now, that's a huge sum of money. That person is very lucky, and many of those people would consider themselves to be very lucky. But there's also lots of people who earn quite a lot more than them. They will be aware of that. But they do pay a lot of money in tax. They probably pay about £35,000 in tax all in. And now that's, you know, that's considerably above the average wage. So those people are already paying lots of money. And if you want to convince those people to pay more money, those are the people you've really got to convince that this money is going to go towards something good. And that's the people for whom a hypothecated tax is probably the most important, because they will say, all right, I will pay more money if you promise to use it to sort this problem. The bad things with a hypothecated tax, well, the economy moves up and down and the tax take moves up and down. So what happens when there's a recession and all of a sudden the tax take drops massively and you've got a deficit? You've got to find money from somewhere else to put into it. What if you end up with too much money? What if the economy does really well? Do you spend more money on the NHS or do you move it elsewhere? It'll be really interesting to see how this plays out, because there's been a big groundswell of opinion going hypothecated tax for the NHS, that's the one place where it would be good. But then you've got a lot of people on the other side saying, don't do this, don't do this, don't do this.
I also think with this hypothecated tax issue, Lee, is it will make people wonder about where does the other stuff go to? People are going to be perhaps a bit more picky. I don't drive. Why should I have to pay for potholes in the road, et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah, well, Georgie, I kind of understand your point on that, but it's kind of, I still think that people are more inclined, you know, you're talking about potholes in the road, and of course, some people don't use the road to drive, but I would say that pretty much everyone in Britain will, at some point in their lives, lean on the NHS, and if it's not themselves leaning on the NHS, it's going to be a family member or it's going to be a friend. So I think people are more in tune with that. But you're right, you know, looking at where all this cash goes.
I was jesting about that because, of course, any delivery, if I go to a food shop or anything, I need...
Love you to find me the person in the country who doesn't ever use a road.
Yeah, or benefit from it. I agree with that. However, the point of knowing where your money is going and trusting it, Simon's just pointed out that during, you know, the heyday years of big spending on the NHS, where did it go? No, if you listen to the Institute of Economic Affairs, they're constantly saying, actually, let's go for the cost-cutting measures. And trim the fat before we throw more money at
and
it.
And that's why I said earlier in the podcast that I think there is some fat to be trimmed within the NHS. I mean, I've seen all sorts of examples of waste, and I have friends that work within the NHS, and it sounds to me like some things that happen there could be probably cost-cut. There needs to be some sort of review of all that. And actually, there's a number of things about the NHS, Georgie, that does worry me about the future. And one of the big things is, I think there's going to be a big skills gap in people and youngsters wanting to get involved in becoming a nurse or a doctor into the NHS. And you see it in the media all the time at how sort of overworked they are and how underpaid they are, especially if you're going in from the ground level. So that makes it quite an unappealing job for youngsters. A lot of youngsters now, they want to work online and digital and all that sort of things. The other thing that I was thinking about with the NHS that could probably help save the NHS some money is actually just improving the GP network within Britain. It feels like in the last 5 to 10 years, something's gone it's been a real backward step. Mm-hmm. I feel like a lot of people sort of don't like to go to the doctor. They feel like they might be wasting wasting the doctor's time. Or on the flip side, they try and get an appointment on the day because they've fallen very unwell. They can't get an appointment that day because you've got to phone up first thing in the morning at 8 a.m. You can't get an appointment. You're seriously ill. You're constantly on hold. And people just give up and go take themselves to the hospital because what else are you meant to do? So that
Putting more pressure on
A&E services. And I actually think the GP network could actually encompass some of this other stuff we were talking about, you know, sort of like mental health issues and all that sort of thing. They could have a more of a kind of, it might sound a little bit American, a little bit crass, this, but a bit of a coaching role, if you know what I mean. So like, let's say, for example, diabetes now costs the NHS £10 billion a year. That's a lot of money. People could be just given a little bit more simple advice by their GP if the GP had a little bit more time for people and say, look, you're going down a road in which, you know, it looks like you're going to develop diabetes type 2. If you don't get a control of your diet now, here's what you can do to help. A lot of the pressure on the NHS are people abusing their own bodies and doing things to themselves that could save the NHS money. A lot of it could be stopped if there was a little bit more campaigning around that sort of thing. I read a stat the other day that for every pound that's spent on a preventative measure, something like it saves the NHS something like £14 or something. So yeah, a good example of that is stopping people smoking. 10, 15 years ago, there was way more people smoking than there is now. A smoking ban has helped massively. I think, again, I read somebody the other day that's saving NHS £400 to £500 million a year from people, you know, not breathing in secondhand smoke. I mean, that's a lot of money. Now, getting old.
Five-a-day coordinator, yeah. Non-smoking coordinator.
Yeah, but you know what I'm trying to say, that there are ways in which we could be helping ourselves.
Yeah, we need to take a bit more responsibility. There's no question about it. I agree with you about the GP network. I could go down this path for a long, long time, but I won't. But Lee makes an interesting point there, Simon, about wouldn't it be better to invest in the technology that would allow perhaps Skype calls with your doctor? I mean, even just a phone call, and I say, you know, if I call up my GP, they say, well, you haven't got an appointment for 3 weeks. Well, why don't I just call them up and ask if I need that appointment? No, sorry, you have to come in first. For goodness sakes.
Yes, and actually, sometimes you have to spend a bit of money to save some money. You don't have to spend much time in a hospital to realise how hideously inefficient they are in terms of the modern digital age compared to where they could be. It just doesn't all work properly. Now, there is an argument that if you were to hand every single doctor and nurse an iPhone or other smartphones that may possibly be able to be used, or some kind of smart device that was all connected to some form of network, someone's been for their x-ray, the person pushes it, yep, that's done, x-ray's done, it's uploaded, here's where you find it, that kind of thing, that you would all of a sudden start to bring in a lot of efficiencies in the hospitals that would mean that people got seen quicker, whether it was emergency care or whether it was appointments for cancer and things like that. And people had a much better experience. And also, basically, you could be more productive. This is how productivity works. You invest in the technology. Now, the problem for the NHS is the last time it tried to invest in a large technology project, it didn't go very well at all. In fact, it was a colossal disaster. So understandably, people are pretty wary of suggesting anything like this, especially when you look at the size of the NHS and you look at how technology has a habit of failing. But the idea would be that you just start bringing this in alongside existing things and then eventually you switch over rather than trying to do a TSB and ending up with some kind of TSB bank style digital disaster
in
the NHS.
Don't do that with our health details.
The other thing is you need to invest in your people. And one of the things we've got a problem with at the moment is people training as doctors and then either leaving our health service to go work in other health services, leaving the health service to go do more private work, or just leaving the health service altogether because they've had enough, or deciding not to train to become doctors in the first place. And we have the same problem with nurses. We have the problem with GPs. I mean, one of my best friends is a doctor, and so I have heard the full gory details of what being a junior doctor involves. And they basically work too many hours. The system relies on people being run off their feet and working far too many hours, and they are exhausted. And do you want to be seen, or do you want your child to be seen by a doctor who has been working for far too long, hasn't had time to even go to the toilet or eat a sandwich during that shift? Or do you want you or your child to be seen by a doctor who feels okay and is enjoying their day? The same goes for nurses. There's an idea that needs to be explored about whether too much stuff always has to be signed off by a doctor. How much of GP's time is spent seeing people who a nurse could quite easily see? And nurses, it is cheaper to train them. There's less training involved than in the doctors. They get paid less money and things like that. But then also there's the places that people get seen. Now, one of the big problems at the moment is GP surgeries. Can't get an appointment for 3 weeks. Only get to see your GP for about 30 seconds. People going to A&E because they don't want to go to their GP and take up their GP's time. They don't really know where to turn. Or people leaving stuff so late that they end up in A&E. So there's this idea that maybe we need to bring in more of a sort of localised urgent care centres whereby it's like a triage thing. So you go there, you get seen, they assess quite how bad you are, and it could be done relatively simply. And yeah, the Skype calls, things like that. I mean, there's a company that does that, Babylon, in London at the moment. It's going great guns. And there's a lot of concern about that running down services. But by all accounts, you hear from tales of their customers and they seem pretty happy with the service that they're getting. So we need to be thinking not about how we fund what the NHS has been doing for the last however many years, but about how we fund what the NHS should be doing 5 years, 10 years down the line to make it work a lot better.
Well, then is it time to get this out of the hands of politicians and into the hands of people that know a lot more about it, dare I say?
Well, arguably, yes. And there's this idea of setting up some form of independent body that actually almost deals with the funding issue and then presents it to the government, and then the government presents it to people and it's discussed. Perhaps it has to be in the manifestos what you're going to do and things like that, but in proper detail, not just magical wishful thinking. There is an argument that there should be, but then I suppose there's an argument that you should take lots of things out of the hand of the government, and then you just end up with either a technocratic society or some kind of weird dictatorship.
Well, let's leave it there. Lee, I want to ask you, in terms of what you were saying about personal responsibility and actually the roles of companies in this, because we got news a couple of weeks ago that Vitality, the insurer, is looking at ways to reward you for making healthier choices. So pensions and its saving products where you earn activity points based on your lifestyle. So if you walk 12,500 steps a day, 5 days a week, you hit the gym 4 times a week, then you don't pay any fees at all for perhaps your pension or your investment ISA. What do you think of things like this?
They've been doing something similar to that, I think, in the last few years. Maybe not to the extreme of, you know, getting fees off of investments and pension and things. But I don't think it's a bad way to look at things. People like to be rewarded for things. They shouldn't. The thing is, your body is a temple, Georgie, and if you're having to be incentivized in which to treat it as a temple, then well, okay, it's a tiny little bit crass, but at the same time, you know, good on a company like Vitality trying to get people healthier, and that should be encouraged. And actually, why aren't we asking for more tax for some of these companies that benefit from us, in which we make unhealthy lifestyle choices? I'm thinking about, you know, fast food companies.
Companies.
I'm thinking about tobacco companies. I mean, people that smoke are already now taxed to high heavens on it. Where's that extra tax going? Is that being pumped into the NHS? You know, there's little things like that. There's little questions in my mind that make me think, hold on a minute, where else could the money come from rather than just going, hey, here's another tax hike? Or do you think a lot of these companies are getting away with, you know, quite big tax dodges in Britain? So why aren't we making them pay their way into the NHS? If they're just going to pump our bodies for of things that we shouldn't be doing and encouraging us via adverts, etc., maybe we should be looking at those guys. And also, another thing I was thinking about extra money for the NHS, and you know, again, this might be a little bit controversial, but I don't mind. I think that, for example,
go for it, Lee.
if you go to the hospital, let's say you're paralytic drunk, or you're incredibly drunk, and I've seen this in hospitals before. People then start shouting at staff, or it could be a real nuisance. And then you're drawing more and more staff out to deal with someone that's being a nuisance for whatever reason. Why aren't we giving some on-the-spot fines to sort of discourage that sort of thing? You know, and that could be put back into the NHS. Discourage people from coming in and using it as a kind of, you know, I'm drunk, you know. Teach people less. I feel like sometimes we're just a little bit, as a country, just a bit too lax on things like that. And look, the easy thing is to do, go, well, it's not easy, but, you know, let's tax people more. People like the NHS, they won't mind paying for it. We should be looking at alternative measures also to start pumping some more money into the NHS and seeing what is actually costing the NHS the most amount of money and what we can do to get more money from companies and other ways.
Love to know your views. Get in contact with us. You can tweet us at This Is Money or at GEC Frost. Lee, just a quick note before we move on to buy-to-let landlords, because I think we've done the NHS enough now.
Yes.
news, we're getting a second lifetime ISA. So talk about government help with which to get us to do something. Lifetime ISA, first of all.
Well, a lifetime ISA, it's kind of replaced a little bit of the Help to Buy ISA, which was when the government gave you a bonus for saving money, which you could then use on a house. Now, what the lifetime ISA is doing, you can pay up to £4,000 a year, up until you're 50, and the government will add a 25% bonus onto your savings. So that's a maximum of £1,000 a year, which is £1,000 free money if you can save £4,000. And then what people can use it for, you can either use it for your first home or you can save it for later life, aka it's almost like a mini pension.
Problem is, those are totally different things to save for. One in the short term, one in the very long term.
And this is exactly what we've said in shows previous. It makes it very cloudy and difficult for people to get in their minds what they should be doing with this money. My thought process is that most people would open a lifetime ISA a bit like they would do with a Help to Buy ISA and use it to buy a property. But, you know, the biggest problem with this, Georgie, is the fact that no companies have really touched it with a barge pole. So we've had Skipton Building Society, who've had one pretty much since the Lifetime ISA launch. And now I think Nottingham Building Society have decided to join the party some sort of year later.
Why is that? They just don't want to go near it because there's confusion?
I think it's a little bit of that.
There's money to be had there. What is the deal with that?
It's more red tape for companies to get through. I mean, I've spoken to bank bosses in the past and, you know, savings directors and whatnot, and they're saying that, you know, sometimes even to launch an ISA, it's quite complicated and it's, you know, shrouded in red tape and difficulties. That's why we've seen a lot of challenger banks coming out and they offer just pure fixed rate savings accounts and they don't offer an ISA alternative because it's complicated and more expensive to run. But there are some benefits to be had for smaller providers to launch these lifetime ISAs. I've seen the stats for Skipton and the amount of people that are opening them.
I've got one.
It's pretty impressive. Yeah. But it's the only place you can open them and the rates are low. So you think, oh, I think it's like 1 point something. It's low.
Yeah.
But it gets bumped up with that government bonus. So actually, it's a pretty good deal if you can know to use it. You're going to use it for a property or you're earmarking it for later life.
Yeah. And I'd suggest, like you said, I mean, there's this argument about whether we'd use it for a pension replacement or you'd use it for a house. I'm thinking house, personally. But Simon, what are your views about this?
I wouldn't use one for a pension. I don't think it's a particularly good thing for a pension. It's inferior to pensions because...
And we should say, if you try and take the money out, you will be absolutely hammered.
So there's some rules attached to this. You have to be under 40 to open one. Mm. You only get that bonus on money that you pay in until you're 50. And you can't get the money until you're 60 unless you use it to buy a first home. So as a replacement for a pension, it doesn't really work because a pension you can still get at, theoretically for the moment, at 55. You get the same bonus uplift through pension tax relief for basic rate. But if you're a higher rate taxpayer, you'll get it, your higher rate tax back as well. And also if you have an employer, then they will give some form of contribution into your pension as well, so you should be maximising that. So does it work as an investment vehicle rather than paying into an ISA? Maybe you get that bonus, that 25% uplift, but then it's very inflexible.
Yeah.
You know, with a normal ISA, you can get your money out anytime you need. Is it worth getting that 25% bonus for it? I'll tell you, the people who it's really working out for are high earners, people who work in, the people who are telling me that they've used them as to invest in, are basically people who work in the city, maxed out their pension allowance, maxed out their ISA, and it's a way of getting a bit more cash. But if you...
Sadly, that's not me and not why I've got it, I should point out.
So then you go for the savings thing, and there's only two deals. Right, so but just because something is a duff idea does not mean that for you personally it might not be a great deal. And I wrote my column about this week. If you are saving for a home, or if you are a parent or a grandparent and your child or grandchild is saving for a home and they've never owned a home before, tell them to open one of these and funnel some money through it, because you will get a 25% bonus on every amount that you put in. So for every £1 that you save by not buying an avocado, the government will give you 25p.
Boom.
Okay, millennials, do you understand that? Yeah? Is that in your language? I know, I'm taking the mickey out of people patronising millennials here, not patronising millennials, just in case that doesn't come across through the podcast. But look, the thing is, do you know how long it would take in order to earn that amount of money on a normal savings account?
Go on.
So a normal savings account pay you about 1.5%, right? To reach that 25% level, you would need to wait just under 25 years
wow.
to get there.
Goodness.
So even if savings rates go up a bit, you're probably looking at about 16, 17 years to get there. You know, that's you know, so take the money. And yeah, it's a duff idea. Not so great on the detail, but it's a good deal for people personally.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I Premium Bonds, giving you the chance every month to win up to £1 million tax-free.
Right, buy-to-let landlords have been hit pretty hard recently. A number of tax changes have left some wondering, well, if it's still worth it. But there are good returns still to be had if you know where to look. But first, a quick one, if you would, Lee. What tax changes are we talking about? How hard have they actually hit the market?
Well, this is it. So a lot of people have actually started to get out of the buy-to-let market, especially in the South East and London, because house prices are pretty high, and some landlords have probably chosen to sort of cash out and get out of it, because the big one is a change that came in last year, which is to do with the mortgage interest relief. Before, you could get 100% back on your mortgage interest relief. Now, slowly being phased out, so it went down to 75% 2017-18 tax year. It's gone down to 50% this year, and then it will go down to 25%, and then it will go down to zero. And for a lot of landlords, that might mean that it's simply not viable to continue having a buy-to-let property, because they're going to lose money on it. Rather than making cash on it, they're going to lose money. And I've seen a lot of landlords really sort of get out of the market from that, and it feels like they've been really quite punished. Mm. And whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, well, you know, it remains to be seen. But it's going to, I still think there's going to be a big knock-on effect on this, because at the end of the day, it sucks out a lot of rental properties out of the market, and there's a lot of unaffordable homes for people. And we're already starting to see some house prices, you know, especially in London, the South East, starting to fall. I don't know. It puts big question marks over whether to get involved in buy-to-let.
However, Simon, there's an article on your website which talks about returns of 12.5%. Where on earth can you get that?
Liverpool. Basically, the idea is this is looking at rental yields. So it's not looking at capital gains on the property, but it's looking at the average rent that you get in that postcode versus the average house price. A site called Totally Money did the sums, and it does this research regularly, and it discovered that essentially student areas tend to deliver the best returns. So the best returns are a postcode in Liverpool, I think LS7, that would offer you this near 12% return. But if you look down the list of places, it's all regional cities, a lot of it's in the north. London and the South East are conspicuous by their absence, and the reason being that house prices are very high there, and you can measure house prices relative to lots of things. You can measure house prices relative to earnings, relative to how they've changed versus inflation, or you can measure house prices by a very simple measure: how much income would you get from renting out that house? And that just shows how expensive houses are in the south of the country.
So basically, the students, but not in London,
but
or the South East.
So then the argument would be, well, are you going to? There's another element to buy to let. So the best thing to do is to work it out on the rental income and invest for the rental income. But what about the capital gain that you might get from house prices going up? Well, obviously, the biggest gains we've seen in house prices over recent years have been in London, the South East, which is why they're so expensive. Are you going to see those continue? Well, they've already stopped for the time being. Could get another leg up. Maybe if you're a value investor, you buy something that's cheap because it gives you more headroom for the price to rise. So that's why. But there are difficulties with, obviously, heading up. If you don't know Liverpool at all, then I would highly recommend that if you were considering investing in a buy-to-let there, that you spent a reasonable amount of time learning a little bit more about it, visiting it, and learning to understand the local market before you chuck your money in.
That's probably not bad advice there, Simon. Okay, so while we've just been extolling the financial virtues of some university towns, Liverpool there, for buy-to-letters, watch out for two in particular if you are drivers. Now, you may remember last week's podcast when we were discussing London's plans to expand the ultra-low emission zones. Now, sensitive am I that I don't become one of those London-centric journos. Simon, you warned that this was something we should all take note of wherever we live, because what comes to the capital is highly likely to be rolled out elsewhere. And low it hath come to pass, it looks very likely, Clean Air Zones will arrive in Birmingham. And I believe, if I'm right, Simon, your old university town of Leeds.
Indeed, yes. Although in Leeds, it will only charge extra for older heavy vehicles such as lorries, buses and taxis. And I must admit that I have never driven one of those. Right. Well, I've never driven some of those. I've driven a small lorry before. Birmingham, on the other hand, is quite a lot more important for the average person because that's going to apply to cars. And it's going to be the same standards as the London zone. So petrol cars need to be Euro 4 or newer. And diesel cars need to be Euro 6 or newer. What does that mean in real person's language? Basically, if your car was first registered after roughly 2006 and it's petrol, you'll be fine. If it's diesel, you need it to have been made after 2015. So a lot more people are going to get caught out there. If not, and you want to drive into pretty much the whole of the central area of Birmingham, you will have to stump up between £6 and £10 per day. Now, for people who regularly drive into the city centre for work, that's going to prove very expensive. There's two things about this that are interesting to note. Well, three things, actually, but one of them I talked about last week. One of them is a very blunt measure. It creates all kinds of weird warped scenarios. The fact that you can drive a brand new Bentley 4x4 as much as you like, but if you want to drive an older car that you've had for years or a classic car, you get hammered. And it's very bad for classic cars. And essentially, this is the government kicking the can down the road. And rather than it doing something to deal with the air quality issue, it has said to all the cities, you need to come up with a plan. That ends up being weird piecemeal policy making that is being done by local authorities when really it should be done by the government. The other point to make is that it's going to affect quite a lot of people. Now, I did a little experiment today on my way cycling to the station, just down one residential road, one street. I counted 33 cars that would be affected by this. That's a lot.
Bless you, Simon.
That is a lot. Now, it's quite difficult to do if you're cycling along, because I was trying to get to the station on time whilst counting the cars. And you need to, and I think that one of the things that people won't realise until this comes in all over the place is, unless you know cars, you won't really realise quite how many are affected. Mm. And there was a clever thing done in the TfL document when it extended the ULEZ that kind of downplayed the number, and it said 100,000 cars a day would be affected by this. But that's just 100,000 cars a day. Now, of course, there's lots of people who live in that area of London between the North and South Circular, but they don't all drive their cars every day. So actually, they've downplayed the figure, because if it was the actual number of individual people's cars who are affected, that number would be really big and people might suddenly get very upset. So, 33 cars. That's a lot of people who are going to be forced to either give up their car or have to buy a newer one. And the final point is that maybe in London you can get away with that. It gets a lot harder once you go out to those residential bits, out to the North and South Circular. But in other cities around the country, especially around the outskirts of the city, public transport just isn't up to scratch. And I had a conversation with a friend of mine, lived in Manchester, about this a while ago. And I said to him, well, you know, the thing is, this kind of thing is fine in London or major cities like Manchester, for example, where the public transport is all right. And he went, no, sorry, Si, I need to stop you there. Bear in mind, my friend works in transport in Manchester. He said, no, I need to stop you there. He said, in London, you just say in London and then it's full stop. He said, in Manchester, the public transport is woeful. You basically could not use it in the same way that you can use it in London. It is not viable for so many people. And he said that's absolutely true of every other major city across the UK. It's only in London that you could really totally rely on public transport or have a massive difference made to your life, particularly if you are a family.
Still reeling from the 33 figure there, Simon. It's that attention to detail that makes you so good.
Investigative exactly. Journalism in action. I did a rain man. I was counting cars, counting cars.
Well, on the note of the fact that it's okay because we can rely on public transport, no, we can't. Help could be at hand. And no, not you, Corbyn, with your nationalisation here. It comes in the form of a new app. Yes, technology again. Designed to match those wanting to travel with empty coaches. Now, hold on. Before you all recall journeys on coaches, which were absolutely horrendous. I wasn't even going to mention names there, but you could mention the Megabus. I've not gone mad because this is a special type of coach and a special type of journey and a special type... Lee, what's going on?
There's a new company that's launched. It's called Snap. Oh, no, it's got a hyphen in the middle of it, so I'm not sure if it wants to be called Snap. App, nice. Which is a little bit confusing, but yes, this is a startup company that are trying to offer a more of a luxe coach service. Which, to be honest with you, having travelled on a megabus once, it's not difficult. No. I will never forget that megabus journey, Georgie. It was to
was a pound.
It was to a wedding last year, and we couldn't find a cheap enough train to get us there and back. Neither of us wanted to drive because, you know, it's a wedding, and you want to have a few drinks. You know, you're gonna have a sore head in the morning. And the train was ludicrous. I think we went to Bolton. That's where we went on a megabus, the glamour.
Wow.
And it was some astronomical price for the train. I mean, it was astronomical, even way in advance. Couldn't make anything work. So got the megabus.
How much was the megabus?
I think it was about £14 return. All I remember is someone decided to bring on a lifetime supply of crab sticks.
Oh, no.
and sat to the right of us and just honestly would not stop munching crab sticks. And then we got stuck in traffic for a couple of hours. And I remember turning to my now fiance and her going, never again. And we go, never again. So anyway, this back to the action topic and hand. Snap app. It's quite an interesting concept because I've never really thought about this before, and actually it does make a lot of sense. You know, a lot of big sporting teams like to get ferried around across the country for fixtures in a, you know, a relatively luxury coach, depending on how good the team is. And they do use it, you know, probably every other week. Let's talk about football. Let's think about football. So if you're going on an away day from London and let's say you're going up to Manchester or you're going a little bit further north, you may fly, but the likelihood is you take a luxury coach. Now, what happens to those coaches when they're the sort of parked around doing nothing? Well, they do exactly that. They're sitting around doing nothing. So this guy has started up a sort of system in which coach companies can bid for like a route. They use algorithms to look at when they think it's going to be a popular time to, say, travel from London to Bristol, perhaps because there's something going on there.
Yeah.
And then they'll look at the customer service ratings of a certain coach company and whatever and have a look at the coach and make sure it's looking like it would be like a luxury coach to use. And you can get on this for a lot cheaper. So they've given us some examples. And again, these are train prices. It's very difficult to get an accurate train price because you can get advanced fares and sometimes it gets skewed if you buy it on the day because it's way more expensive. But for example, they've got London to Cardiff here, which is not that lengthy a journey. £117 for a train ticket that leaves at 6:15 and it arrives at 8:15. So it's 2 hours. A snap app. So they do it for £7.70 and it takes about an extra hour. So it depends on how much you value your time. So if you're happy to save £100, but it'll take an extra hour and you've got the issues of potential traffic jams and stuff. I mean, your trains also break down, but, you know, more likely to get stuck in traffic, then it might be a worthwhile app to look at. Now, I think at the moment it hasn't got that many routes. That's probably going to be a problem. It's going to have to match up with your own travel requirements. But I wouldn't mind giving it a go if it was like a luxury coach. Do you know what I mean? Like, rather than one of those mega buses and crab sticks and the thought of, you know, that toilet at the back. And it'd be interesting if this grows. The argument is that, you know, this will offer a viable alternative to train travel and, you know, relatively inexpensive, but a little bit more of a luxury way to go.
What's nice is just the fact that people are trying to think of innovative ideas because at the moment it is pretty rubbish.
Yes.
Normal coaches and the rail network. Simon?
Yeah. I think this is a really good idea. I'm surprised you don't get more of it, bringing people, actually, commuters in. I know there's one that runs from Oxford. It's called the Oxford Tube. And one of our former colleagues used to get it in. But there's a brilliant quote here from this guy, Mark Anderson, operator of Anderson's Travel, which is one of the companies that supplies the coaches. He says, "The coaches we provide to Snap app..." Okay, I'll go back to the beginning. "The coaches we provide to Snap are normally used by elite sports teams and executive groups. They are literally the best way to travel imaginable, but often go unused, especially during the working week. With Snap, we can give Premier League travel experiences to everyone. Bring your own massive headphones," is all I can say. If you really want to look like a Premier League footballer.
I don't want to travel Man United's bus. I want to go Man City or something.
This is a brilliant idea. And I reckon a lot of people would be willing to take a little bit longer to get there in order to save themselves extortionate sums of money. It could be actually very good for families for whom it's all very well one person paying an extortionate train ticket to get to another city in the country. But try paying it for four people. And all of a sudden, you've just had a... you've just had the price of a holiday on a train to Manchester on a Friday for the weekend or something.
Do me a favour, does anyone have the Uber app on them? The reality is with this, right, if you were going to go, let's say, to Cardiff, like you said, what was it, 115 quid?
Something like that, yeah.
It's right. Getting to the stage now that if you perhaps booked an Uber, for example, and you split it four ways, if you can arrange for people to go together, that's probably going to be cheaper than getting...
Oh, no, I would have thought...
A train nowadays, and this is ridiculous.
Unless you get advanced fares, Georgie.
Simon, have you
okay,
got...
Okay, right, I've got Uber up here, and at the risk of accidentally ordering an Uber to Cardiff...
what are you up to today, Simon?
The thing is, I need an address in Cardiff, don't I? Does anybody...
Millennium Stadium.
Cardiff Stadium, do you reckon that will work? I've got Cardiff...
The Royal Mint.
Cardiff Stadium House. Right, okay, here you go. Right, okay, this might take... hang on. Uber X, I've got £197 to £262. And so... I've got a button at the bottom that is just asking me to press it. Confirm Uber X. Confirm Uber X. Do not get £200 Uber to Cardiff.
Okay, what's that, 50 quid?
Is UberX just the normal Uber?
I've no idea.
Yeah, that's just a normal Uber.
That's 50 quid? That's a lot cheaper.
I mean, it's a lot cheaper. If it's last minute, especially because, you know, let's say for whatever reason you need to go to Cardiff today, some pressing reason you've got to go to Cardiff. If you went last minute at the train station, you will get the highest possible train ticket price for doing that. You'd rather get an Uber, wouldn't you? You know, especially if there's two or three of you, it makes sense to split it. It's going to be way more comfortable a journey.
My wife occasionally has to travel to Leicester for work, and I mean the cost of a train ticket to Leicester is from London is unbelievable when you consider that Leicester is not that far away. And surely there can't be that many people who all want to go to Leicester in the morning. But she has to travel at that kind of time. And it's no good arguing, oh, well, you can get cheap tickets if you're careful about what times you travel. It's like, yeah, that's awesome if you're retired and you can travel on a Tuesday and come back on a Thursday. Yeah. But every other normal person in the country actually does need to go on a Friday, come back on a Sunday, or needs to go in the morning for work and things like that.
Have you suggested Megabus to her? You can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I Premium Bonds, creating millions of reasons to celebrate every month.